UK Wine Show number 190 for the 15th of January 2009. Tasting sessions with David Swaddle. G'day and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and we have another cracking wine show for you this week. The beginning of the year, in London anyway, is a big time for tastings, and there's loads of Burgundy on-premiere tastings going on, as well as the New Zealand trade tasting. I didn't manage to attend the Burgundy tastings, even though I'd planned to, but I did manage to get to the New Zealand trade tasting. The New Zealand tasting was my first chance to try out my project, which has been the focus of much of last year. I said last week I was going to announce what I'd been working on, and well, it's called Winescriber. Winescriber is an application that's designed for tablet PCs and phones for quick entry and managing of tasting notes. It runs on a Windows PC and on Android and phones. It's very cool. It's touch-based, although if you're running Android's latest operating system, you can enter tasting notes by voice, which is quite nice. The nice thing about Winescriber is that it's a device that has a copy of the information on it. So even if you're not connected to the internet or a Wi-Fi point, you can still enter your tasting notes just like normal. Then it syncs up to the cloud, or my server in the internet, if you like. That way you can enter notes on something bigger than a phone, then it'll sync up with your phone and you can view them on your phone. Also, your PC at home can obviously sync up and do all sorts of stuff on that, so that's pretty cool. I gave Winescriber an outing at the New Zealand trade tasting, and it performed very well. There's a couple of wee issues to be resolved, but nothing too much, and we're getting ready for a beta release of the software. I plan on making the beta version ready for a small group to trial it in February sometime, not quite sure the exact date yet, and it's designed to work really well with the new slates that are coming out later on in the year. If anybody's ever heard of CES at the Consumer Electronics Show, slates, which are tablet-type PCs, you know, with a touchscreen, are going to be all the rage this year. I'm not sure if it'll run on the new Apple iSlate, as Apple haven't really announced what they're going to do with it, and it's quite a closed operating system. But at the very least, you should be able to use it on the browser. Well, there's a load of techie geek talk in that. Anyway, the device is pretty cool. I like it. But it's not just about writing loads of computer code. There's a database in behind that stores all the appellation controllers, regions, producers, all that sort of stuff, which means that you can enter things very quickly, because if you know the first couple of letters of the appellation controller, you can get all the information about its region and a list of producers that are in that appellation quite quickly. So that's one of the key things about it, is to be able to navigate very quickly and select the wines you want, just so you can get to the important bits of entering the wine notes that you want. The reason I created it was I used to go to loads of trade tastings and I'd make notes on the books provided. You know, they always give you a book about all the wines in the tasting, and I'd make diligent notes on them. Then I'd get home, look at them maybe once or twice, put them in the cupboard and then forget about them for 6 months. And then after about 6 months or a year, I'd end up throwing them out. So you'd go to these tastings, make lots of detailed notes, but you couldn't reference them, or they weren't really, you couldn't look them up and refer back to them. So the idea of Winescriber is to get around that problem. The observant of you guys may notice that Winescriber is also my Twitter account. That's not just a coincidence. In terms of opening up for you guys to have a look at, it'll be sometime in February, probably late February. I want to set up a test version and have a warm, fuzzy website so you can have a look at. At the moment, it's all about entering notes and syncing, so it's just the core functionality that we've got at the moment. Later in the month, I'll be asking if anybody wants to be a beta tester, and if you'd like to be on trial, you can get in contact with me then. Well, that's a big announcement this week. I'll keep you up to date every couple of weeks or so as we hit each milestone on the release, and if you see me at a tasting, do come along and say hello, and I'll more than happy give you a quick demo for a listener of the show. Okay, from one computer application to another. This week, we're going to be talking with David Swaddle. He's put together an e-learning course on the WSET Intermediate course, and it's known as Tasting Sessions. Tastingsessions.com is the website. We talked to Dave about how it works and who'll benefit from it. In the spotlight, we're looking at the second part of blending wine. If you recall, part one was a long time ago, just before Christmas. But this week we've got part two, and we finish it off part three next week. And there's a wee small change to our mystery wine region / wine grape this week. We're going to be talking about a mystery producer. So here's the first clue. The second clue will be coming up after the news. And the answer's at the end of the show as usual. Our Argentine producer began in 1902 when the family immigrated from Italy and planted its first Malbec vineyards in Mendoza. His son, Domenico, took the family winery to the next level by becoming the largest vineyard holder in the region. By the 1960s, the family was struggling because of the state of the Argentinian economy, and when the son took over the reins in the middle of the decade, he concentrated on expanding the distribution throughout the country. In the early 1980s, he went to California to become a visiting professor at the university there. It was grape growing in California, and in particular Napa Valley, that inspired him to return and sold his table wine producing company to focus on the fine wine bit of the business. As Argentina was perceived as a bulk wine producer at the time, his colleagues thought he was mad. But becoming convinced that the certain varieties could flourish at high altitudes, he set out to discover which and where. I'll give you the other clues after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Demand for fine wine ahead of Chinese New Year is soaring, especially for Bordeaux first growths. That's according to Gary Boom, Managing Director of Bordeaux Index, who said the company was receiving orders from Asia worth up to £500,000 a day as clients gear up to celebrate the Year of the Tiger on the 14th of February. There's been a trend over the last 2 years for giving fine wines as a gift, and this has become the trader's busiest time of year outside Enprimeur. Boom thinks the surge in interest in Bordeaux suggests China might be a serious player in the Enprimeur market during 2010.
People have been talking about China's rise as a buyer of Bordeaux. Historically, though, they are considered not to be a buyer of Enprimeur wines. However, if people are buying wines as gifts, then someone needs to sell them to them. So merchants could become increasingly important in the Enprimeur market. Interestingly, if more wines are being carved up and given as gifts, these wines will become less valuable on the resale market. Single bottles or even cases that have not been stored in recognised stores are not as valuable as those that are purchased by speculators and stored in professional wine stores. So, an increase in demand could push prices up on newly released wines, but you could also see a bigger spread of older wines, some well stored and some have spent time in someone's house. Either way, it does give Hong Kong more influence in the wine market if Enprimeur does shift towards China. From one wine trading island to another, what's going on in Sark, Jane?
Well, billionaire twin brothers David and Frederick Barclay, who own the Daily Telegraph and the Ritz Hotel in London, amongst other things, are planting their first vineyard on the island of Sark in the Channel Islands. They own the neighbouring island of Brecco and already own land on Sark, which has a population of just 600 people and offers residents tax-free status. The brothers have recruited Pomerol winemaker Alan Reno to plant up 5 hectares of vines on several plots around the island, comprising Chardonnay, Chenin Blanc and Pinot Gris. Sark is on the same latitude as the Loire Valley, and the intention is to make top-quality still and sparkling white wines to sell to tourists. Planting should begin in April 2010, with the first vintage in 2013.
According to reports I've read, the brothers aren't looking towards a massive export. Apparently, they see the wine meeting more of a tourist market. Interesting enough, they point out that they're in the same latitude as Loire, but surrounded by water, it's going to be a lot milder climate. What's the last story, Jane?
Finally this week, a French Sauvignon Blanc called Kiwi Cuvée has been prevented from being sold in Australia because of its name. The producer, La Chateau, tried to register the name in Australia, but the New Zealand Wine Growers Association complained, claiming it could cause confusion with Australian consumers, who would assume the wine was from New Zealand. In Australia, the term Kiwi, of course, has a strong association with New Zealand, and the association argued that it should be reserved for New Zealand wines. Kiwi Cuvée is produced in the Loire Valley and already sells in the UK and Europe. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website, www.3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I love this story. For years, the EU, driven by France, have been going around the world trying to stop people using their identity to sell wines. But it does seem as though the French pay little attention to that themselves, and I'm pleased to say it's been banned in Australia. It should also be banned in the UK. The wine is made by New Zealand winemaker Ryan Woodman. And the New Zealand Herald reported the Marlborough Grape Growers Association president Stuart Smith said the French winemakers were misleading customers by using the word Kiwi. If we tried the same thing, we'd be in court faster than our feet could touch the ground. The dodgy label, designed to tempt fans from New World Sauvignon Blanc, would hurt sales of genuine New Zealand wine, he said. New Zealand wine growers should also get the wine banned in the UK, but I doubt this will happen. Speaking of New Zealand wine, I went to the New Zealand trade tasting and tried an interesting Sauvignon Gris from New Zealand. It's the first one I tried from New Zealand. It had a classic Marlborough nose, but a lot less acidity and quite fleshy. Imagine a Sauvignon Blanc with a Pinot Gris body. I suppose that's how they get the name. But apparently Sauvignon Gris is just a clonal mutation of Sauvignon Blanc, so it's not a crossing between Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Gris, just a mutation. So interesting. The other strange wine was a sparkling Sauvignon Blanc I tried by Montana. Now, it's been selling the wine in New Zealand, and they brought a few bottles over here to see what people thought. I tasted it, and it was okay, but what bothered me was it was made using carbonation, so not at all anything to do with the second fermentation, not even tank or charment or traditional second bottle fermentation. According to Montana, they experimented with bottle fermentation, but they found the wine to be reductive. I also tried a similar wine from Mount Riley, which had a bottle fermentation, and it was quite reductive too, so I can see where they're going with it. I just don't like the idea of sparkling wines being made using a soda stream. If anybody's got any comments, I'd love to hear what you say on it. You can email me at chris.scott@3050.co.uk, or you can Twitter me at winescriber. Hopefully you'll remember that name now. Or you can put a comment on my Facebook wall at Chris Scott. I think it's quite interesting, and I don't like the idea, although the wine was okay. Straight Sauvignon Blanc is okay, but many good wines are made of blends. And this week's Spotlight, we're looking at part two of our blending. It was a while since we did part one. I think it was before Christmas. So if you want to catch up, you can see part one and part two notes on our website. Go to 3050.co.uk, click on podcast, and on the left-hand side is a load of different hot topics. Right at the very bottom, it's under winemaking. So scroll all the way down there, and then there's these notes on blending. Complementing a variety with another is one of the huge benefits of blending. The blender knows what they have, and they can trial blend wines and know what they're going to get. This gives flexibility and certainty to the blender. But another type of blending is to add grapes together before fermentation. This was how wines were traditionally made and blended. Different grape varieties were grown in the vineyard and together picked and fermented together. In mixed vineyards, as this is known, the speed of ripeness is important. For slower ripening varieties, these can add acidity and green flavors. Selecting the grapes and the proportion of each was essential. But, for example, some frost can affect grapes at different parts of their cycle, and the resulting blend and quality can vary from year to year. However, in more temperate and consistent climates, such as in Italy, this is still practiced. And you may remember from just before Christmas, we spoke to Suzanne Crociani from Montepulciano, and they grow mixed vines in their vineyard. A more common reason, though, for co-fermenting isn't because they're all in the vineyard and they all go into the vat together. It's to create unique wines. Here, molecules from one grape combine with molecules from another to create flavour style that wouldn't occur if they weren't fermented together. Perhaps the most common of these blendings is Shiraz with a dash of Viognier when they ferment the two. This creates a wine that is rich, but also has a delicate top floral note that can't be achieved by just blending Shiraz and Viognier together. Alcoholic fermentation is not the only fermentation used for blending. Malolactic fermentation is another significant change in the wine. Here, the wines with crisp malo acids are softened to lactic acids through malolactic fermentation. Blending the two wines allows people to control the perceived acidity of the wine. The last form of blending is across different years, or non-vintage wines. All non-vintage wines are made up of at least two vintages. This is to give consistency to the wine, smoothing out any variability of vintages to give a more consistent quality. The most successful of this is non-vintage champagne, but there are other types as well, such as sherries, and many types of port are also non-vintage. It is uncommon to see still wines and red wines to be non-vintage, except for the very cheapest on the market. That ends the spotlight. I have another small topic on blending next week. But before we have our interview, we have the second clue in our mystery producer. Our mystery producer over the last 20 years, the patriarch and his daughter Laura, along with vineyard management team, have worked to identify and develop microclimates in high altitudes of Mendoza. Planting countless varieties and clones throughout their 300 hectares of mountain vineyards in the quest for quality, Malbec and Chardonnay are the company's signature grapes. Visitors to the vineyard won't just be bowled over by the fact that the winery is a state-of-the-art, but is also architecturally because the bodega looks like a Mayan pyramid. The last big clue is, in 2009, the current owner and patriarch was made Decanter Man of the Year. Have we think about that? I'm going to give you the answers after our interview, which is coming up next. This week, we're going to be talking with David Swaddle. Dave produces e-learning packages for big pharmaceuticals, but his passion for wine has sent him down the road of creating an e-learning course for those who want to do their WSET intermediate course. Let's have a chat to Dave about that. Hi, I'm here with Dave Swaddle. How are you, Dave?
I'm good.
Excellent. You run a... well, an interesting type concept. Do you want to just describe what exactly your company is?
It's Tasting Sessions, yes. And we have the first interactive WSET intermediate course available. The idea being that people who want to take the intermediate course, sometimes if they're in the hospitality industry or they live outside of a big city, find it quite difficult to find somewhere where they can do it very easily. And by making it available online, still following the same syllabus and things, it just extends the reach of what people can do.
Wine tasting WSET, it's all about wine. It's very hard to drink a CD.
It is exceedingly hard to drink a CD. I've never actually tried it myself.
How do you get around that problem?
In the course, at the end of every chapter, whether it's a country or a grape, we've taken a bunch of experts and we videoed them. So we encourage people to try the wines, either if they're in the trade, maybe on their own, because the wines will be available, or if they're sort of general public consumers who are interested in wine, as a group, and then compare what their tastings are to the experts that we've videoed. And in total, I think we've got 69 wine videos in the course for people to compare against, and 4 spirits ones, because there's a little spirits section as well.
If you're tasting a New Zealand Savvy, you buy a New Zealand Savvy. Do you make recommendations? Or
we've got some wines in there. None of them have been sponsored. They've all been ones that we've found or we've been filming somewhere, and it happens to be one of the wines that they sell. But we've tried to make them quite typical, so it should be easy if you can't find the exact wine to find something that's from the same region that's going to taste roughly the same. We're not going out of our way to find peculiar wines, because we're trying to teach people what things really taste like from an area rather than what the unusual things from the areas are.
Sure. Okay. And so what happens? Do I just log on and start doing it online? Is that how it works?
Yep. Basically, it's the same course as the WSET's intermediate if you do it face-to-face, just split into the 11 countries, 6 chapters on grapes covering 8 grapes because some of them are paired up together, a little bit on food and wine matching, a bit on service, on health, a bit on the background to producing wine and the factors that influence the style and the quality of wine. All is very small chapters. In total, if you did it from beginning to end, probably about 30 hours. But it's designed to do in sort of bite-sized chunks of an hour or so at a time. Depending on people's involvement with it, they can do a lot of further reading. We give them links to go off and look at other things. But the core course that's there is about 30 hours. Most people, we would say, it's a 6-month thing to do where they do the learning themselves and then get together with their friends for the tastings. But if someone wants to do it in 4 or 5 days, they can steam straight through it and go and do the exam as quickly as possible.
I did my intermediate, I think, in 3 days or 4 days or whatever.
It's very popular as a 3-day course, I think, face-to-face.
I did the 3-day course and then I did my advanced in a 5-day course like the next week.
Braver than me.
I tell you what, the headaches I had. It's like you get home at 4 o'clock, you've got a hangover.
Yeah, I spent 13 weeks doing my advanced and I enjoyed every one of them.
Excellent. The courses, are you trying to encourage people to get together? Are you creating a way for people, if I'm doing the course in Manchester or one of the big cities?
Yeah, so we're looking at a few things, which will have hopefully some stuff set up in January, particularly using some Facebook groups and things to allow people to exchange messages, so that you might be in, I don't know, the countryside just outside Sheffield or somewhere, and then through that to try and find some other people who are looking at starting the course as well. But quite often it seems that from the people we're meeting, they already know people who are into wine and they're looking at doing it as groups of sort of already established people. And we'll just play with lots of the technology that's there to see what gets people together best, because we don't want to go reinvent the wheel on this, on the social networking side. Yeah. We want to use what's already there.
It's the intermediate WSET.
That's right.
And there's no tasting exam, is there?
There's no tasting exam.
So how does someone do the exam?
We've set up with a centre in London to start with. Then as people enrol in the course, we'll look and see where they are in the country and set up places for them to do the exam. We're looking at Manchester, we're looking at Newcastle at the moment as two cities to do them in, where we'll then do them, depending on demand, every 3 months or every 6 months, so that there'll always be someone somewhere to do the exam reasonably locally. Or we may provide it through some partners as well. That's another investigation that we're having.
WSET's got quite a good network.
Yeah, we only got our WSET approval the day before the wine show. So now we can go out and talk to all the other WSET approved program providers and see how we can work to provide the exam more locally, and possibly also some sort of partner tasting classes and things where we provide the learning, but then people get together for a weekend to do a bit of revision, do a bunch of tasting together, to make go through questions and things with someone face-to-face, and then do the exam, which gives someone the benefit of being able to do the course over a period of time and think about it and learn and enjoy it, but then that little extra reassurance just at the end. But we're investigating all that. There's quite a few people who are sort of interested in hooking up with that.
Yeah, yeah, weekend away tasting wine sounds great. I tell you what, and after the exam, big party!
Yes!
Sounds great. Sounds great. We used to just go have beers after the tastings. But
yeah, in the classes we did, it was quite often we find we didn't quite taste enough in the class, so we'd just have to go and add a one or two on afterwards.
What about things like faults? I can't remember if I did that in the intermediate or not.
Faults aren't really covered at the intermediate level. There's a little bit just about them, but we're not going to get people to go and we're not going to send scent packs out of faulty wines and things at this level. That's much more in the advanced. So at this level, it's not really a major part of it. It's much more finding typical wines and learning to identify those fruits, the fruit aromas, the different aromas that are in there, and picking out what the key markers are for a Pinot and getting a bit of a hint as to whether that's cool climate or hot climate, getting people that sort of really good ground understanding. Afterwards, hopefully, they'll follow on and do an advanced course or something where they will things in a lot more depth.
And have you done your intermediate, Dave?
I'm a naughty boy. I skipped the intermediate and did the advanced, which is where the idea for this all came from. I actually went to do the intermediate at a local college, and the course got cancelled. Because there weren't enough people to run it that time, and I just went straight on to the advanced because they decided I knew enough about wine to do that. Three of the people on who were going to do the course worked in local hotels and restaurants. None of them managed to find a course to go and do, and they're all going to be customers. So,
you get your first three customers lined up?
Yep.
Okay, and you know, not to make this into a big plug, but what the heck's it called and how much does it cost?
It's Tasting Sessions. It's Tasting Sessions Intermediate.
And what's the website? Or
www.tastingsessions.com.
Yep.
And the course is £250 plus VAT.
And how does that fit with the WSET courses?
It's roughly the same sort of costs at the end of the day because you've got to go out and buy some wine samples and things. So it's headline price is a bit lower, but the real cost of doing it, it's about the same.
But you get to drink a lot more wine.
You get to drink a lot more wine and have a lot more fun with your friends if you're doing it together. The other thing is that you don't have to commit to having the same evening free for 12 weeks or to being able to get that sort of three-day long weekend and really cram it in. So if you're someone who wants to take your time to learn and let it sink in, it's a very good way of doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And any? Do you use the course books or anything like that? WSET got the wines.
Yeah, we've got a study pack that comes with the course. So there's the WSET's own book, the Behind the Label book. We've got a little tasting card. Inside the course, there's a whole bunch of games and things for revision and stuff. And
well, games, that's good.
Yeah, so we've got a quiz show game at the end of the New Zealand chapter and lots of sort of quick-fire ones where you have to answer as many questions in 30 seconds just to see whether you've understood what you were going through because there's no teacher there to double-check. So we get you to double-check.
Yeah.
And just to help with the revision, we've also got notes that you can print out as you go and we encourage people to maintain their own tasting sheets and sort of put together a portfolio of their tastings from throughout the course. Really, people should be tasting about sort of 40 to 50 wines, ideally. Which is why we say 6 months is ideal, because you can do a couple of weeks then with your friends.
Yeah. 40 wines in a weekend is just... you can taste them, but you cannot drink that many. Anything future? Are you looking at doing the advanced afterwards? This is obviously a new product.
It's a new product. It came around because I run an e-learning company, and we normally do stuff for the pharmaceutical industry, but this is a much more fun product. So we've gone from drugs to drink. I don't know how this happened.
Similar price for product, isn't it? I didn't say that.
We are looking at some other things. We're looking at, on the advanced side, the advanced course, you really need to learn to taste with other people. But what we're looking at doing is sort of advanced modules, picking specific countries or regions and making just a very sort of compact course on those regions. But we'll see where we get to with this one first. We're also looking at the possibility of a beginner's course, so one below this sort of level. But that's probably not for your sort of shows audience. I would imagine it's more for some of their friends.
Yeah, sure. The people who don't know anything
Is there anything you think is missing out there wine course-wise that people need?
No, they need to go to my wine courses that I run in London. I do a fantastic one-day wine course.
One thing I will say with this is, because it's e-learning, I will always say that it's better to do things face-to-face, because you get more interaction with the people around you. You get more personalization of what goes on. The teacher can look at you and figure out what's exciting you and what's not. We are following a very rigid syllabus with the WSET. Yep. But it's just never as good as doing it face-to-face. But there's a lot of people who can't get to do the face-to-face training. That's really why we're doing it. If you live in the middle of Cornwall and you're 30 miles drive from the nearest place you can do it, you're probably going to have more fun with your friends in the village pub.
Exactly. Okay then, Dave, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
Right, that ends this week's look at wine education. In fact, it ends our look at wine education for the year. We'll come back to wine education next January. I like to start the year off with a bit on wine education. Don't forget to check out their website, tastingsessions.com. As a heads up, I'm doing some travelling in March to New York, New Zealand, Australia and Hong Kong. And I'm trying to work out who I'm going to interview, particularly in New York and Hong Kong, where I've really not spent a lot of time there. I'd like to talk to an innovative retailer, restaurants and merchants, as well as some interesting people in the trade. I have some ideas about who I want to talk to, but if you've got some ideas, do get in contact. I'd love to have a chat. My email address is chris.scott@3050.co.uk. I'm going to be putting my itinerary together over the next week or two, so if you do listen to the show and you've got some ideas, do send them through to me. That's chris.scott@3050.co.uk. Okay, we just have to answer our mystery wine producer and the quote, and we're all done. It is, of course, Catina Zapata, one of Argentina's top producers, and the owner is Nicholas Catina. Right, here's the clues again. Argentinian producer Catina Zapata began in 1902 when Nicola Catina immigrated from Italy and planted his first Malbec vineyard in Mendoza. His son, Domenico, took the family winery to the next level by becoming the largest vineyard holder in the region. By the 1960s, Familia Catina was struggling because of the state of the Argentinian economy, and when Domenico's son, Nicolas, took over the reins in the middle of the decade, he concentrated on expanding the distribution through the country. In the 1980s, he went to California to become a visiting professor at the university there. It was grape growing in California, and in particular Napa Valley, that inspired him, and he returned and sold up his table wine producing company to focus on the fine wine bit of the business. As Argentina was perceived as a bulk wine producer at the time, his colleagues thought he was mad. Mad, I say. But Nicholas became convinced that certain varieties flourished at higher altitudes and set out to discover which and where. Over the last 20 years, he and his daughter Laura, along with the vineyard management team, have been working to identify the key microclimates and high altitudes of Mendoza, planting countless varieties and clones throughout Catina's 300 hectares of mountain vineyards in the quest for quality. Malbec and Chardonnay are the company's signature grapes. Adriana, Catina's vineyard in Tupungato at 1,500 metres, is home to Sauvignon Blanc, which I have not tried their Sauvignon Blanc yet. That'd be interesting. Visitors to the vineyard won't just be bowled over by the fact it's a state-of-the-art vineyard, but also its architect, because Bodega Catina Zapata looks like a Mayan pyramid. Okay, that pretty much ends this week's show. One last thing is the quote. Luckily, I was given a wine quote book recently for my birthday, so it's called Quotable Quotes, and this quote comes from there. It's a Japanese proverb. At first cup, man drinks wine. At the second, wine drinks wine. At the third, wine drinks man. I think we all know what we're talking about there. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.